This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Good morning. You made it. All the way through. How many times did you think about leaving? Really? I always think about leaving retreat. So a couple things about integration and going back into the world. How we live this, the Dharma. Buddhist path is a lifestyle choice, and it really has to be integrated into all aspects of our lives. These retreats are so important, so wonderful to have some time to really just slow down and concentrate the mind and be mindful of each and every moment to the best of our ability. And it's hard enough here to do that when everything's taken care of and you don't have any real responsibilities. You just sit and walk and eat and sleep. It's even more difficult to do that in the busyness of our day-to-day lives. It's a challenge, it's a practice, it's a process. Got some wonderful advice last night from Stephanie and from Doug about the importance of community, the importance of daily practice, the importance of dedicating our life to being of service, to finding right livelihood, to practicing, earning money in this world in a skillful and wise way. Hopefully that brings benefit to others, not just to ourselves. A couple of the supports for living a wise and compassionate life are the commitments to the five precepts, and Ron is going to speak to us and lead us through a ceremony of vowing to yourself to live in accordance with these basic ethical guidelines. And Jason's going to speak to us and lead us through the formal process of taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and Sangha. Of course, they'll talk to you about this, but of course it's optional if you want to take refuge and if you want to take the precepts. It's up to you. But we find it to be a great support to have this sort of commitment, this inner commitment to some renunciation and to commitment to taking refuge in the three jewels. So we can do that. We have some handouts. Why don't we get those going around?
So we come to the end. So honored to start the retreat by giving the first instruction, and also I'm incredibly honored to talk to you about sila, morality, the five precepts that the Buddha gave us to to learn how to live our lives in a way that really takes all that we've learned. I've learned so much over the last 4 days from all the teachers and from you. Got to deeply practice and learn about wisdom and concentration. And the third part of the path, the part of the path that we will take with us as we go out into the world is sila, morality, how we act, what we do. Vinny described our life as how we write scripts and how we can write a shitty script or a beautiful script. So with our actions, that's the part of the script where it says car chase or gunfight. Hero couple have sex. That's the part of the movie that we get to write also. And we do that in our actions and what we do and how we are in the world. And these rules, these precepts, and a precept actually means it is a rule of training, it is a general rule of behavior. They're not like the Ten Commandments. There's no one watching you. It's not like Santa Claus finding if you've been naughty or nice. It's not something that you do that's dirty or shameful. They're rules of training because we're human beings and because our nature is to act in certain ways. And the Buddha knew this about himself and he knew it about us. So he came up with rules for us to practice in our life as we go about our business, how we treat ourselves and how we treat others. Now he said to Raghula, his young son, if there is a deed, Raghula, that you wish to do, reflect thus, is this deed conducive to my harm or to others' harm, or to that of both? Then is this a bad deed entailing suffering? From such a deed, you must desist. If there is a deed, Rahula, you wish to do, reflect thus. Is thus deed not conducive to my harm, not to others' harm, nor that of both? Then this is a good deed, entailing happiness. Such a deed you must do again and again. So, and against the stream, talking about conduct, Noah writes, ethical conduct is based on intention of non-harming and compassion toward all. The real revolutionary is committed to non-violence. The Buddha's radical stance of non-violence is a wise and practical path to personal and societal change. When we commit to waking up and revolting against the ignorance and oppression of classism, racism, sexism, and all forms of hatred and delusion in this world, the first step we must take in that revolt is a personal dedication to purify our actions from these things that cause harm. And the minimum commitment that is necessary for the path toward the enlightenment and freedom is renunciation of taking life, of dishonesty, and of sexual misconduct. Those are three of the five. So there's a minimum we need to do. And these are the five precepts. I'm going to take you through them, what they mean as minimum, and also how we can interpret them in a wider sense. And I'd like to say that we'll go through them and then we'll actually take them as a vow. Vows are really important, and so I want to read them to you first and describe them a little bit, because I don't want you to take the vow if you're not ready for it. If there's any one of the five that you feel you can't commit to, it's really important that you don't say it. Just keep it. It's okay. Maybe later. And I want to tell a quick story. Well, the first time I met Noah, I took a 5-week course. It was summertime, and it was in this little bungalow in Santa Monica. And I think maybe it was the second or third lesson. And Noah talked about who has become this guy in Buddhist character in Buddhist history, Angulimala, who was a bandit. He was a highwayman. He was a murderer. He collected, his name actually means garland of fingers. He would stop people on the road and he would kill them cut off their fingers and wear them around his neck as a necklace. And he created a lot of negative karma for himself. And when the people got wise to this danger of going on the highway, he would go into their homes and take them from their homes and murder them. The Buddha saw the suffering that was being committed both to the people, the victims of Angulimali, plus himself. And so with his compassion, he went out to meet him and introduced him to the Dharma. Angulimali became a monk, shaved his head, renounced his wicked ways, and actually became eventually enlightened and an arhat. But he totally accepted the fact of his karma and what he had created. So when he would go into the towns to collect alms food, the families of people who he had murdered their family members and who held deep resentments would stone him, throw things at him, and beat him. And he would accept it with compassion and equanimity, understanding that this was what he did and he was responsible for it. So I loved Angulimali because I too took life, I stole, I cheated, I used my sexual energy in negative and harmful ways, a drug addict and alcoholic. Every precept I spent a lifetime breaking. And when I came to the path, the greatest change I got was through my actions, by behaving in a different way, by living my life in a different way, and not some holy Joe way, but in simple ways. My life began to change. So all of the stuff we do has great subtlety and refinement, and we can change our lives through everything that we've been taught here, including how we act. So let's look at the precepts, the rules of training. So, how we'll say them, Jason shared this with me, I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh. We start each one by saying, seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of not intentionally killing any living being. Before we take them, I just want to go through them quickly. So, these, again, are baseline behaviors. It's not only not killing, it goes beyond not killing. It goes on to nurturing life, fighting for peace, opposing brutality in all of its forms. Two, we undertake the precept of not stealing. And again, it's not just not stealing, it's being generous. It's the baseline is not stealing, and then from not stealing we go to being generous and using all of our resources to help others, and not only ourselves. We share. I undertake the precept of being wise and careful with my sexuality, non-harming. This one is really a subtle one, and we are sexual beings. How we behave to each other sexually and what we do with our sexual energy really can be a force of loving and kindness and union, communication, or it can be a taking and a grasping, a brutal thing. So when we take this precept, we're looking towards how much can we give, not how much can we get. I undertake the precept of being wise and careful with my speech, truth and usefulness of speech. It goes beyond just telling the truth and not lying. It's not gossiping. It's not saying what doesn't need to be said. It's not using rough speech or harsh speech or any communication, our email, our blogs, what we say, we can't take back. We put out an energy into the world that becomes part of our karmic momentum. So we need to be careful how we speak and communicate with each other. And then the fifth one, I undertake the precepts of refraining from the use of intoxicating drink and substances that lead to heedlessness. Well, as a recovering alcoholic and drug addict, this one's an easy one for me. I know the benefits of sobriety. The Buddha is pointing to the fact that we spend so much time trying to free our minds and trying to open our heads and be clear and see what exists. Why would we befuddle that? Why would we take things substances into our body that are going to confuse us and make us behave in ways that perhaps we really wouldn't do if we weren't drunk or high. Now, of course, this doesn't mean medicines, as Noah pointed out. The Buddha suggested that and believed absolutely in medicinal requirements for the human body. I'm not talking about that. So again, these are choices that we make. Some of them are hard, some of them are easy. Obviously, if you're a hunter, you can't take that first precept. Obviously, if you're planning on going home and scoring a whatever, don't take it. Save it until you're ready to take that precept. Yes?
I have a question about that, though. So, like, I am not an alcoholic, and I drink wine. So, in retreat, I would never consider a drink, but at home, if I have a glass of wine, is that considered then something, you know, it's to heedlessness, and my understanding is that if you can be mindful, that having a glass of wine is not considered breaking the precepts. On the other hand, there's a delicate line there.
Like every part of this training, it's for you to determine, not for anyone else. There is no Santa Claus finding out if you're naughty or nice. The point of this is, what does it mean to you? My wife drinks wine, and she is also a practitioner. That's her choice. You know, I mean, each one of us has to determine what that means. If we can drink without getting to heedlessness, perhaps that's okay. That's not what the Buddha said, but that's okay. I mean, really,
need to... That's why I'm asking, actually.
Yeah,
because
you know what,
I think... My upbringing and my background, that's not actually... It's the precept is to heedlessness, not to not do it at all. And so that's actually why I'm bringing it up.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, and it's important that all of you understand that these are not external rules. These are internal rules. You need to follow them and see what behaviors net what result for you. I mean, this is something to study and work with. Yes?
Would you say the same thing about being vegetarian and the killing?
Yes, that's a very good question. The Buddha lived in a time where food was way more scarce than it is today. And so there was no prescription against the eating of meat. It was the killing of animals. You could not be a butcher or go and pick an animal or hunt an animal and kill an animal as a bhikkhu, as a monk. People would bring you the food they had, so you would take whatever is given. So if someone gave you meat, you would eat the meat. That meat couldn't be slaughtered for you in particular. You couldn't go out and get that cow or go in and pick that fish or lobster and that be your food. In this world, it's a very good question. In this world of hunger, and where so many animals are being fed and taking food from others, it's interconnected. You can see then in stealing or taking what's not given. That's a big question. You know, these are, again, ethical moralities that you must find for yourself. So just like the drinking one, you have to determine which one works for you and how far you want to go. And, you know, it's like Pablo was talking about, this is your practice. And give me liberty or give me death. It's really up to you. You can be as fundamentalist and hardcore as you wish. Yes?
I think I might be fucked on this one because I have a winery for a living. So is that considered not right livelihood, production of wine?
I'll let Noah answer that.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yes. Truthfully, in the list of rules. No. It isn't a question of being fucked. It's a question of being on a path. You're on a path, and you can see and see if that perhaps is right livelihood or not. You have to determine that. It's not for someone else to determine. Yes.
I would love to share something that I heard Thich Nhat Hanh say once, when asked a question by someone whose work was around nuclear armament, not nuclear disarmament. And Thay said, I would rather have someone with your mindfulness making the decisions about these really powerful weapons than someone without your mindfulness.
Yes, and that's thank you very much. That is a equanimous way of looking at right livelihood, which is better you than you know, the Gallo brothers selling Nitrang, you know, I mean, I used to drink that. So, but again, these are not, these are rules of training for you to discover. Maybe at some point in your life you will determine that that isn't what you want to do. For myself, you know, I'm in the film business, and I've done commercials, and I did commercials for all of the wine companies, and I sold beer and cigarettes, and I hawked every kind of horrible thing. I don't do commercials anymore because I really can't. I don't want to sell useless shit to people that they don't need. So that's a decision I make, and you know, it's not an easy decision, and it's something that we look at. It's again, we bring our mindfulness to it. These are not harsh rules. These are rules of training. These are general rules of behavior for us to interpret for ourselves, just as the wisdom piece and the concentration piece. It's something we develop. It's a strength. It's a liberating factor, not an enslavement to us. It's not like, oh my God, I can't do that thing. It's perhaps you don't want to do that thing because it is going to set you free.
Yes.
I also practice with a Nathan tradition, and I've avoided taking the five precepts because of his tradition. It's not written this way. It's very specific and very precise behavior that you must live by that I just can't do. And a lot of people in my group have taken precepts, and I feel kind of like this hierarchy of people who are holier than I am. And I don't like that. So I want to know, why there's a difference. Why is this one reasonable, and why is that one more like being, you know, like Ten Commandments? Like,
no, that's
what you will do is what you not do.
Again, a beautiful question. You can go back and look into the traditions and the various traditions, and you will actually see very specific behaviors. For example, under sexuality, there are lists that are very clear about what is right and what is wrong. Those were written 2,500 years ago. We have a present reality and an understanding of sexuality that is perhaps slightly different than they had 2,500 years ago. But the general understanding, the point, the meaning is doing no harm. That's really the important part of it. And so we chose these in our lineage, these are the ones we use. It's perfectly acceptable to go deeper than this and look at what the tradition is. But the Buddha said you can't put anybody's head above your own. It's your practice. So, you know, if it doesn't, I think that hierarchical quality isn't helpful to practice. It's your practice. You have to find your way. And I love Thich Nhat Hanh. I think he's a poet and a beautiful man in every way, an artist, a peacemaker. But he comes from a tradition that he's perhaps enslaved to in some way. So I suggest you find what's right for you, and you take those precepts and live by those rules, and continue to open your heart to not having a fixed view, but allowing what works and doesn't work, what leads to happiness and the end of your suffering, because that's what the Buddha said he's about, is the end of suffering, your suffering.
So I'll just actually speak to that also, and these other questions. These precepts that we have printed out are pretty direct translations from the oldest recorded teachings of the Buddha, the Pali Canon and the Theravadin tradition. And by all Buddhists, they agree that this is the kind of closest to what the Buddha said himself. And these five precepts are pretty much verbatim, word for word, what he suggested and how he suggested and how he worded it for householders, for those of us who are not taking the renunciation of monastics. Thich Nhat Hanh has, and in the Vietnamese Zen tradition, I actually think that Thich Nhat Hanh has taken some real liberties in how he has interpreted that, and he's expanded the interpretation of these precepts well beyond what the Buddha originally said. So of course, like Ron was saying, it's all open to interpretation. Likewise with this often Mahayana interpretation of the fifth precept around it's okay to drink a bit, just don't get too heedless. If you look at the wording here, what the Buddha's original suggestion was, refrain from putting into your body substances that lead to that state. He did not say, refrain from putting so much into your body that you become heedless. He just said, it's a good idea to not take wine, because wine can lead to heedlessness. That's a good idea not to take pot. To not be taking the pot. Because quaaludes can lead to heedlessness. So I agree completely with Ron, and I think all of us pretty much up here hold a view that says we can each figure this out for ourselves, and it's totally cool to be really committed to meditation and to Buddhism, but to say that precept, not so into. I love my wine and I'm not giving it up. totally cool to do that. My own feeling is not so good to rationalize it. Not so good to then put in the Buddha's mouth that he thought it was cool. Good for us to understand the Buddha's intentions for us. And then us saying, like, well, I get that that was what the Buddha was suggesting, but I'm not into it. I'm somebody who likes to gamble on occasion. Although gambling is not in the five precepts, there's other places in the Buddha's teachings where he says, gambling is a really bad idea. He said you hang out with drunkards and thieves and you squander your money. That really, if you're serious about being mindful and awake, not such a good idea. I, like Ron, am a recovering person, so not drinking easy. I don't drink. I don't use drugs. But I choose to break this suggestion, this precept from the Buddha around playing poker. And I see it completely as a place where I am not in line with the Buddha. And I know that, and I don't rationalize it as, well, the Buddha, you know, what did he know? I think that he's right, I'm wrong, and I choose to be out of integrity in that way because of the pleasure that it brings me. And I think that that's what's important for all of us, to say, it's okay to be out of integrity. It's okay to make these choices based on our what brings us pleasure, but not so good to pretend like to make up stories about why it's all good.
Yeah, because then you'll wind up like a Gulamali carrying your karmic momentum with you, and people stone you, you'll understand.
So this next piece, before we take the precepts, or whichever ones you want to take, 3 out of 5 is not bad. When I did a Thich Nhat Hanh retreat many years ago, I took 3 precepts because I thought I could commit to the kind of honesty that he was asking for, and I could commit to the kind of nonviolence that he was asking for. But I couldn't commit to the type of sexuality. He's saying to abstain from sexuality unless you're in a committed long-term relationship. Which isn't what the Buddha said. And I said, for me, you know, I'm on the road. If I might have a casual encounter at the time, I was like, I want to have that freedom. And so I'm not going to commit to that sort of precept the way that he stated it. I forget what the other one, maybe the other one was around speech. Oh no, he interprets intoxication not only as drugs and alcohol, but as intoxicating films, conversations, magazines, and music. And I said, oh, for me, I can't commit to that. I love intoxicating music. Love intoxicating. I'm, I, you know, I'm not going to stop seeing intoxicating films. So I said, for me, I won't take that in that tradition. But this is probably closer to what the Buddha said than the way that he interprets it. So where I'd like to shift, what I'd like to do next is we have these blessing cords for you. And we're going to do this ceremony where you can take the precepts and the refuges. And Jason's going to talk about the refuges in a moment. But before we do that, I'd like you to all come up and to receive a blessing cord from the teacher that you interviewed with. Now, some of you jumped around and saw some different teachers, but why don't you come to the person that you interviewed with on the first day? So go ahead, come up, stand in front of them one at a time, get in line. There'll be seven people in each line. And you can, the teacher will give you this cord and you can bow to them and you can express your gratitude. If you want to say thank you, if you want to say whatever you want to say, you can say whatever you want and they'll give you a cord. And then just return to your seat and wait for the next piece.
Eric. That was nice. So, refuges. We've heard a lot about refuges. A beautiful chanting of this American Buddhist style anti-folk chanting of some deep words, you know, really powerful. And the intention behind the refuges, you know, Pablo also spoke a little bit the other night about in the freedom conversation about the refuges, about the taking refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in the Sangha. And then we have these blessing cords. So yeah, I'll talk a little bit about, you know, what refuges mean for me. What I understand them to mean as people came to the Buddha, or the Sangha that was created around the Buddha, that they were really asked to take these refuges to go forth. You know, the refuges and the precepts, the training rules kind of grew over time. But really, all that you needed to do to follow the path of the Buddha at the time of the Buddha was to really just say, I take refuge in the teaching, in the teacher, and in this community. In some ways, it was a form of protection, which is why it became a refuge, the idea of refuge. I was thinking of what else the triple gem, the three jewels, mean to me. And I thought of safety, that going to these three stable places, both in myself and in this community, that I really came to the Dharma, came to this practice for safety. Safety from myself. Safety from my mind and my habits. And I also think of trust as part of the refuge. Taking some kind of trust or reliance in the one who knows, the awakened Buddha, and the potential for awakening within myself, just as the potential for awakening is within all of us. So I think about that trust and that reliance. And the Dharma and the teaching passed down from generation to generation, teacher to student, for thousands and thousands of years. And that it's pretty uncut in this tradition. And I really like that. So
of having some reliance and some trust in the Dhamma, in the teaching, the truth. My favorite way to describe the Dhamma is the truth in nature. And then the Sangha, I see the Sangha as protection also. By having friends like these and like you, they help to protect me from my own greed, my own hatred, and my own delusion that pops up from, you know, time to time. And by having this idea of refuge for me is about always knowing, taking, like always knowing that there is a safe place that I can always go to. And I don't have to go very far. Sometimes I just have to draw from my head to my heart. Most of it's there. Sometimes I gotta make a phone call. So I also find the inspiration in the Buddhist teaching, in the teacher, you know, the blameless one, the unstained. There's all these ways to describe in the suttas. Purified. But there's this ideal that we are all kind of pointing to. Freedom, liberation. And that taking refuge in the Buddha is taking refuge in not only in the inspirational kind of teacher. Whether it's, you know, teachers today or all the way back. The fully awakened one. But it's also, again, that getting that inspiration for our own potential, our own ability to have an awakened heart and mind. And then also seeing that inspiration within the Dhamma, and especially within the Sangha. Maybe something that somebody said this week inspired you. That Sangha. Maybe a book you read or another teacher you had. Some kind of inspiration. So in taking refuge in these three jewels, it's the literal, the teacher. The Dhamma, the teachings that we've been sharing this week, and then the ultimate kind of Dharma, the truth in nature, the truth of all things. And then the Sangha, the community that has carried this tradition for thousands and thousands of years so that you can hear it, so that we can experience it. And then also the community within, just right here, this American Buddhist rebel against the stream kind of idea that Noah, you know, illuminates in his wonderful books. So that's a couple words about what taking refuge means to me. And we, like I said, we've been chanting it so you guys have a view or an understanding of the words. But we're going to do it a little different now. We've had the kind of the new order of chanting. And now we're going to bring back a little bit of kind of the monastic, Pali tone to this chant. So if you can get your papers out. So also, you have your cords. And one of the reasons why we have these cords, these what are are called protection cords. But I think of them as inspiration cords, remembering cords. Is that we're going to fold these precepts, fold these words of refuge into this cord. In some ways, it's called powering it up. All the good intention that was created here. So, you know, feel free to hold on to them. Don't tie them on your wrist yet. We'll do that in a minute. But feel free to hold on to them or put them somewhere while we're chanting. So we'll do this call and response. I apologize for my lack of musical talent beforehand. But we will do this call and response, and we'll do it both in Pali and in English. And so we'll only say the English one time for the Namo Tassa, just like it said here. But we'll go through it three times. So call and response. Namo.
Namo.
Tassa.
Tassa.
Bhagavato.
Bhagavato.
Arahato.
Arahato.
Sangha.
Sangha.
Sambuddhasa.
Sambuddhasa.
So now we'll put that all together. Okay. Namo Tassa.
Namo Tassa.
Bhagavato.
Bhagavato.
Arahato.
Arahato.
Sangha Sambuddhasa.
Sangha Sambuddhasa.
Namo Tassa.
Namo Tassa.
Bhagavato.
Bhagavato.
Arahato.
Arahato.
Sangha Sambuddhasa.
Sangha Sambuddhasa.
Homage to the enlightened Buddha.
Homage to the enlightened Buddha.
And we'll go down. Buddham saranam gacchami.
Buddham saranam gacchami.
Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Sangham saranam gacchami.
Sangam saranam gacchami.
I take refuge in the Buddha.
I take refuge in the Buddha.
I take refuge in the Dharma.
I take refuge in the Dharma.
I take refuge in the Sangha.
I take refuge in the Sangha.
Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami.
For the second time, I take refuge in the Buddha.
For the second time, I take refuge in the Buddha.
Second time, I take refuge in the Dharma.
For the second time, I take refuge in the Dharma.
Second time, I take refuge in the Sangha.
Second time, I take refuge in the Sangha.
Tatyampi Buddham saranam gacchami.
Tatyampi Buddham saranam gacchami.
Tatyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Tatyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Tatyampi Sangham saranam gacchami.
Tatyampi Sangham saranam gacchami.
For the third time, I take refuge in the Buddha.
For the third time, I take refuge in the Buddha.
The
third time I take refuge in the Dharma.
For the third time I take refuge in the Dharma.
For the third time I take refuge in the Sangha.
For the third time I take refuge in the Sangha.
So now that we've powered up the cord, then take a moment and just think about what these words, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha mean to you. And we're actually going to tie three knots. We're actually going to tie four knots. But we'll start with three. Around taking refuge, being clear for yourself, your own, taking refuge in your own potential or in the Buddha, the teacher, or whatever's true for you about Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and put that, and tie that one knot at a time into your cord. And then for the fourth knot, a personal intention for the next year. Something that you want to kind of power in, build in an intention for, when maybe some of the suggestions that Doug gave or Stephanie gave last night, something that you've came to during this retreat, an intention for the next year. Thank you.
Now we'll take the precepts. We'll start by saying, it's not on the paper, each time, seeing how deeply our lives intertwine. All right? So we begin. How would you do this call and response? Seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of not intentionally killing anybody.
Seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of not intentionally killing anybody.
Seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of not stealing.
Seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of not stealing.
Seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of being wise and careful with my sexuality.
Seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of being wise and careful with my sexuality.
Seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of being wise and careful with my speech.
Seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of being wise and careful with my speech.
Seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of training from refraining from the use of intoxicating drink and substances that lead to
evilness. Seeing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the precept of refraining from the use of intoxicating drink and substances that lead to evilness. So this sacred piece of black yarn is now supercharged, and traditionally people like to wear them around their neck or around their wrist. You can do whatever you want to with it. If you care to tie it around your wrist, that's a nice thing. Then you wear it basically until it falls off or until you get sick of it and you cut it off. And it serves as a reminder, and you see it there on your wrist all of the time. Some people like to wear them around the neck. Whatever you like. If you want to just put it in your pocket and take it home, put it on your altar or somewhere where you'll see it regularly when you meditate, it's up to you. But if you'd like to tie it on, now's the time. And you could help each other. If you're somebody who needs a little help with the tying, take a moment to do that.
It's actually great to just turn to somebody else and allow them to help you.
So we're just going to hear something from Matthew. And then we'll take a short stretch bathroom break. So you're okay, you can hold it for another 5 minutes. Matthew's just going to share something with us. And then we'll take a short break, and then we'll come in for the final piece.
It's been, I would say, very poignant watching you all soften. So I'm speaking here for the group in expressing our gratitude for your effort. That this practice, as we've said often, deepens connection. And as we feel less and less separate, the joy and spiritual growth of others becomes more and more beautiful. And seeing this in your faces is heartbreakingly beautiful. Many of you have expressed appreciation for what's happening here, for the work you've done, for what's being offered. And any gratitude you do feel, my advice is to let it burn. Let it burn deeply. And there are times when, after a retreat, for my teachers, for what Noah has created in this world, that the gratitude feels so strong that it's like a burden. It's like a weight. And the only way that I can ease that sense of burden is to practice the Dhamma. And this is what we're asking of you. Because this is the Dharma feels very relevant. But we're asking this to be a kind of moment to recall when the Dharma begins to feel less relevant and less alive. To keep a kind of thread to the beauty of this experience. And as we move out into the world, our practice is to share the Dharma in very quiet and humble ways. I was, so a few years ago, I was feeling very inspired by the practice and kind of a little evangelical about it. Like I just wanted to be out on the sidewalk screaming at people to meditate. Sanity, right? So I was on retreat and I asked one of my teachers, I said, why isn't Buddhism evangelical? Right? It's we know it, the benefits of this. Why isn't it evangelical? And he said, who said it's not evangelical? What the fuck are you talking about? So, who said it's not evangelical? He says, it absolutely is evangelical. We're just classy. Ha ha ha!
world, and we make very humble offerings of whatever wisdom and compassion we have to share. Very quiet, humble offering to all that we encounter. May this be so.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.